Well, I hope you're awake and attentive for another episode of The Far Middle. And I don't want to hear any excuses about losing an hour of sleep this past weekend due to daylight savings time. Come on, this is The Far Middle, and that should be enough in and of itself to re-energize and fire you up. So let's get moving. Our sports dedication for this episode is going to start from a strange place. I've been a follower, sort of a fan of Rand Paul's for some time, the senator from Kentucky, basically since he was elected in the Senate over, 10 years ago now. And I'm a supporter of his fiscal restraint on government spending, as well as his libertarian slant on individual rights and protection of the individual from the administrative state. And I guess that draws its lineage back to his father, Ron Paul, who was clearly of a libertarian mindset. Now, interestingly, Rand Paul was born in Pittsburgh, but he moved at a relatively young age as a child when his dad moved his medical practice to Texas sometime in the late 1960s. Anyway, what does the sitting senator from Kentucky have to do with a far middle sports dedication? Well, Rand Paul's ascension into the Senate came about because of a political battle that ensued within the Republican Party in Kentucky that involved a Hall of Fame Major League Baseball pitcher. So let's lay out the dots that will start to make these connections for you. This Hall of Fame pitcher that I'm speaking of is Jim Bunning, who many present-day sports fans may not even recognize, which is a shame. He was a Kentucky native, and he got his big league start in the mid-1950s. He achieved quite a few impressive milestones, so check this list out of what he achieved during his career. Bunning pitched his first no-hitter on July 20th, 1958 for the Tigers against the Red Sox. Then in 1959, Bunning struck out 3 batters on 9 pitches in the 9th inning of a 5-4 loss to the same Red Sox, and Bunning became only the 5th American League pitcher and the 10th pitcher in Major League Baseball history to accomplish what's known as an immaculate inning, striking out all 3 batters on 9 pitches. Then came a trade to the Phillies, and Father's Day in 1964. Bunning, who at the time had 7 kids, he pitched that day against the Mets, and he posted the first regular season perfect game since 1922. Bunning played for a few more teams, including my Pirates, before retiring in the early 1970s. His 2,855 career strikeouts, this is another little interesting tidbit of his career, puts sort of baseball in perspective on how things change. So his career strikeout mark of 2,855, that placed him second all time when he retired on the list, behind only Walter Johnson, who, by the way, was a recent Far Middle dedication subject himself. But then Bunning's career strikeout mark was later surpassed by other pitchers as time went on. And if you look at that all-time career strikeout list today, Bunning is currently not even in the top 20 all-time. So he went from second all-time to not even in the top 20. So that might be why a lot of sports fans today don't know of him, despite being in the Hall of Fame and achieving a unique collection of on-the-field accomplishments. But people today, they should know of Bunning, especially for what he did off the field and after he retired from the game. He, again, was one of those exemplary Americans that we've been focusing our sports dedications on for some time here with the Far Middle. Now, when he was still playing, Bunning was a leader of the Players Union. In 1965, he helped hire legendary Players Union leader Marvin Miller, who changed the economics and thus the nature of pro baseball forever. And then after retiring, Bunning represented players individually as a player agent. He eventually represented as many as 30 players at one time. So he was sort of a super agent before super agents. Then in the late 1970s, Bunning, he gets into politics. And he served on a local city council. He then won a seat in the Kentucky Senate as a Republican. And then he was the Republican candidate for governor of Kentucky in 1983, which was an election that he lost. In 86, he won the Republican nomination in Kentucky's 4th congressional district, so he joined Congress. And then in the late 90s, he ran for U.S. Senate, and he won a tight race. To this day, Bunning is the only person to have been elected to both the United States Senate and the National Baseball Hall of Fame. How about that? And he was one of the more conservative senators during his tenure. He was noted for, I'll call it, some bizarre behavior and remarks at times. And looking back and reading the record, he sort of reminds me of a combination of Trump and Biden when it comes to gaffes and irritability. The national media didn't like him much, maybe in part because he was conservative. Then came 2009. And this is when we finally make the connection back to Rand Paul. So Bunning was out of money with regard to campaign finances. He had really low approval ratings, and he was fighting with Republican Party leaders, including fellow Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell. The 2010 election for Senate was looming, and Bunning eventually, he saw the writing on the wall. So he decided not to seek re-election, to run for re-election to another six-year term in the Senate. But he did so with a twist, because in April of 2010, just prior to the primary, in a further show of disdain for GOP leadership and insiders, Bunning announces that he's going to support the outsider candidate, Rand Paul, over the establishment favorite. Rand Paul, he romps to easy victory in the primary and then an easy win in the general election later that year. And that, constant listeners, is how a Hall of Fame pitcher from the late 1950s and 1960s has a direct connection to a current sitting senator from Kentucky. It's another sports dedication that isn't so much about sport as it is about the unique journeys and opportunities that present themselves in America. So episode 147 is dedicated to the right-handed Hall of Fame pitcher and center-right senator, Jim Bunning. And maybe we double back and make a reconnection as to why I like Senator Rand Paul. Perhaps the biggest reason is, as I said, he's a champion when it comes to protecting the individual from the bureaucratic state. He sees the danger that the system presents to the individual, and he's been the most consistent defender of freedom of the individual that you're going to find in the Senate. In his ongoing battles with Anthony Fauci and the cover-up regarding gain-of-function research with COVID in Wuhan, China, that's a prime example of Rand Paul in action. So Paul might not be perfect, but he does remind us all of the need to be on constant guard against what he references as moral busybodies in government. The great author and thinker C.S. Lewis said it best with, "Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. Those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience." Well said, C.S., well said. He summed up one of the foundational themes and missions, I think, of the Far Middle's advocacy. And that's where I want to focus our discussion for this episode. What Rand Paul or C.S. Lewis or libertarian-minded thinkers often stand for was summarized brilliantly back in 1859 by a guy named John Stuart Mill. His masterpiece was On Liberty. I implore you to give On Liberty a read. It's not a long work, it's easy to follow, and you're not going to find a more thought-provoking work that resonates more in 2024 America. It is freaky how a person wrote something in 1859 about a subject and about issues that we see happening all the time in America today. I published a commentary on the topic that should be posted by now on nickdeolius.com, hopefully by the time of this episode's airing, so check that out on the website if you get a chance. Mill, he wrestled with figuring out how in a democracy, one should protect the people from a government of itself. How does one protect the minority from the majority? In a republic or a democracy, the tyranny of the majority, it can deny the rights of the minority or the dissenter. Individuals can easily be oppressed within a climate of collective opinion, and maybe by values that might be popular, but that haven't been critically tested. Mill believed, and he thought, that the individual is not accountable to society for actions if they concern the interests of no one else. Society might be free to express its dislike for the views or actions of that individual, but it should not suppress the individual from expressing or acting. Only when the individual's actions directly harm the interests of others in the society is the individual justly going to be subjected to some sort of social or legal punishment, and only if society feels that those things are necessary for its protection. And by the way, that also doesn't mean that the damage to the interests of others alone justifies interference with the individual. Think of competitive economy. Competition and commerce, that's going to yield winners who gain, and that's also going to produce losers who suffer loss. Society or the state, it doesn't have the right to impede or interfere in such competitive efforts or endeavors. And suppressing individual action cannot be justified simply because it would be for the individual's supposed own good. The individual gets to decide and choose what is best. And the individual gets to speak freely because freedom of speech and thought, those are prerequisites for individual freedom. Louis Brandeis would famously sum up on liberty's core sort of ideas and concepts with the following. The right to be free is the right to be left alone. Well said. The key question for Mill was how much power society can legitimately exert over an individual. That's a simple question, but it's been one that's confounded and divided societies for centuries. And just because a government is elected by citizens and its representatives are from the people, that doesn't mean that there's no threat to individual liberty. Political power, it can be used by one class to coerce another. We've seen that many times. And it doesn't matter if the oppressor is a king or if the oppressor is an elected president or legislature. Mill highlights that government should not coerce the individual even when the majority agrees with government. He gives an example. If everyone save for the single individual were of one view, they still don't have the right to suppress the opposing view or desire of that single individual any more than a single person has the right to suppress the view and desires of everybody else. Now, society can impose more oppression on the individual than even government in certain situations. And there is a potential that there's going to be massive societal cost to suppressing individual thought and action. If those individual thoughts and actions led to sort of great breakthroughs, and if they catalyzed or inspired or advanced society, they're not going to be realized if they are oppressed. And that comes at massive cost to wider society. But libertarians and classic liberals, we recognize that there's got to be some rational level of rules of conduct. You're going to need those if you want a stable society. It can't be a free-for-all. In societies in different time periods, they're always landing on different points across a very wide spectrum of possibility. On one hand, sort of anything goes, no rules at all, a free-for-all on one side. And then on the other end, on the other side, you know, very totalitarian, authoritative types of governments and societies. And then a whole host of possibilities in between. I got an idea that I think might be an interesting exercise. Let's go through a series of connections, pulling out key thoughts or key statements from On Liberty, and then pairing those with a current day contemporary example of that thought in action. That might be the best commercial that I can provide to you to try to convince you to give On Liberty a read. So let's see how this goes. One of the thoughts that Mill had was that collective feelings of a society, they should never trump reason when you're setting the level of individual freedom and dissent in a society. What's a contemporary example of that in play today? I think a great reminder of that is every time today you hear someone in the radical environmental movement shrieking denier to try to silence those who have the audacity to voice dissent. That's exactly the type of danger that Mill was warning us about. On Liberty also reminds us that the only situation where coercion of the individual, and you can coerce an individual either by trying to stop them from doing something or by compelling them to do something. The only time such coercion is justified, whether it's by government or society, is to prevent direct harm to others. And he also coupled that thought with the idea that the individual should be sovereign over themselves. And that's with respect to both body and mind. When you're denying those types of things, the sovereignty of the individual over themselves, that necessarily means that society is oppressing. So you take those two thoughts together, real world or current day examples of those at play. Vaccine mandates, I think, are a great example or illustration of this. And you can also see both pro-lifers and pro-choicers latching onto those concepts to try to bolster their views or their opinions on that subject. Altruism. Mill looked at that as being the enemy of liberty. And that whenever you're trying to force others to be like you so that they may better themselves, that essentially is going to be anti-liberty. And that to me sounds like something right out of an Ayn Rand essay, a more contemporary sort of parallel for me at least. On Liberty also instructs that the suppressing of an opinion, it doesn't just rob the individual expressing the opinion, but it also robs society from hearing what might be truth. And even if the suppressed view or opinion is not true, it's going to prevent society from hearing the falsehood disproven so that society becomes more assured of truth sooner if you're suppressing that opinion. Now, what's an example today? Well, think of the suppression of opinion that we saw recently by the expert class and on social media and by Anthony Fauci, who we mentioned earlier, when it came to gain of function research with COVID and what was going on in that lab in Wuhan. Mill employs a really clever example, illustration in On Liberty. It's with religion. He uses religion as an example of why society shouldn't suppress individual rights. Societies and its majorities, they can be passionate about religion, right? That's been true for centuries. But Mill points out that religion is typically assigned at birth and by coincidence as to where and when one is born. It's not assigned to you because it's been the religion that's been proven to be the right one. Now, you think about today, you got both sides of the political, ideological spectrum sort of using religion as a way to suppress individual rights. You've got the right that's looking to sanction an official religion through things like requiring school prayer. And you've got the left looking to shun certain religions by mocking or vilifying Christians or Christianity. And both of those efforts threaten liberty. You also read in the book that there's a big difference between thinking something is true because it's not been disproved by dissent versus thinking something is true to justify oppressing dissent to it. So what do I think about today when I read that? How about when Al Gore or John Kerry speaks of the need to censor climate disinformation, as they call it, on social media and the web? When they're doing that, they fail to heed Mill's sage advice. Mill also said sometimes society or government wrongly protects certain beliefs from critique, not because they're true, but because they're deemed important. And just think about today, the current battles over woke culture, it's a perfect parallel to Mill back in 1859. He also, this is one of my favorite sections of the book, he provides a great historical context in On Liberty. History shows the law is used at times to destroy noble individuals and their noble ideas. The noble individual in those instances may have been killed, but the noble ideas, sometimes they lived on. So what are some examples of this? Well, today we applaud Socrates, but his society and his law put him to death for what was thought as a sound reason at the time. He had the sort of the daring to dissent, which was unacceptable. The same is true for Jesus, who was killed by society and the system. Why? Because he was different from the norm, and most everyone thought it sound judgment at the time. Now, today, we condemn those who killed Socrates and Jesus, but we might be making the same types of mistakes. Mill points out that Marcus Aurelius, who I'm a big, avid fan reader of, he was a great man. He espoused virtue. But what also did he do? He persecuted Christians who were displaying the very behavior that he was touting. Now, it made sense to the Romans at the time, but it looks illogical today. So Mill, in his book, he challenges the reader. He says, if you think that you are wiser than Marcus Aurelius, who made that type of a mistake, then go ahead and persecute what you are convinced is wrong and that society agrees with you is wrong. And I think looking at things today across the United States and the West, unfortunately, many today feel confident enough that they are wiser than Marcus Aurelius because they do that very thing. John Stuart Mill, he also understood truth is often defeated by persecution. You know, truth doesn't always prevail. We like to say that that's not always true. And the same truth, it can be killed over and over. It can experience multiple murders over time. Just think of the myriad of energy transition myths forced upon economies today. We've talked about this extensively over Far Middle episodes. Zero carbon electric vehicles, reliable wind and solar power, low cost battery storage, on and on. Reality, it's now helping to expose these myths, and reality may eventually resurrect scientific truth. But in the meantime, right, scientific truth, it's murdered over and over again with energy policy. The classic On Liberty also highlighted how individuals, they can lose moral courage when society suppresses free expression and dissent. And that's a huge price to pay for preserving the intellectual status quo. Free thinkers, you know, they're either going to not speak out, or when they do, they may camouflage ideas by blending them in with safer concepts. Look at what's going on today. That's what many contemporary business leaders do when speaking on controversial but important issues that they may disagree with when it comes to public consensus. In public, they're going to speak in vague code if they speak at all, while in private, they're bluntly speaking truth, and that presents a problem. Great thinkers, Mill pointed out, must follow their intellect and follow that intellect to logical conclusions. If society wants to know all that it can, then it's going to have to allow everything to be published and accessed. So when you look at today, the left censoring social media or the right banning books, those aren't good things. Those are wrongheaded. Mill also pointed out the worst offense for society is to hold individuals with opposing views as immoral. And sadly, today's ideological thought police, boy, they offer too many examples to list. We could spend a whole episode of The Far Middle just going through that list. Mill pointed out that society benefits from genius, but genius, it requires individuality and freedom. Everyone appreciates a genius in art. So when some musical or literary genius comes on the scene, everybody loves that. But those same people often disdain contemporary genius that disrupts political, economic, religious, or scientific status quo and power. It's quite inconsistent. And looking around today, how many thought leaders are going to run risk of being labeled as something like fascist or be reputationally ruined the moment that they dare to diverge from the majority consensus or from the elite ideology? There's so many examples to go through on liberty. I'll just give you maybe two more. Nonconformity. The book does a great job pointing out that that is going to require social and institutional tolerance. And if the state blindly follows public opinion, you're going to have progress held back. Let's think about today. Remember when those universities of ours used to serve as the marketplace of ideas to nurture nonconformity and progress. But now academia rigidly worships the religion of the left, with the ivory towers serving as the churches and the professors as the priests. And then maybe one final thought from On Liberty, using a social right to suppress an individual right, that's a dangerous threat to freedom, and it can falsely justify the suppression of personal liberty. You assess things like the environmental justice movement of today, vaccine mandates, disinformation censoring campaigns on social media. Those are examples of those very dangers that Mill warned about. I hope I gave you a good flavor for On Liberty. You've got to give that book a read. America desperately needs a On Liberty redux and refresh. It's a brilliant illumination on the importance of the individual to thrive. Conformity is going to lead to decline of civilization. Tyranny of opinion is going to kill eccentricity, innovation, and progress. It's that simple. Government, it should refrain from acting in arenas where the individual acting is likely to be superior. And, you know, even if the individual may not do something particularly well, it is still better than government action because the individual at least gets to grow their own capacity and capability by doing. Capitalism is a good example of this. The individual engaging in competitive commerce, that is a social act. So you should avoid government restrictions on trade. That's wrong. And there's only going to be a few discrete exceptions that justify such restraint. And then restricting the interference of government also avoids the danger of unnecessarily growing government power. Mill pointed out that if you have roads and railways and banks and universities and charities becoming effective extensions of government, even a free press in our Constitution is going to be ineffective in preserving freedom. And one just has to wonder what Mill would think looking around today. He also worried if business, this was interesting, if business fell into the control of government, the best people would go into those businesses and into government. And then everyone would end up looking to government for direction and decisions. And the ambitious, they would want admitted into the bureaucracy of government. Now, in such a situation, even the president and Congress, they would become slaves to the bureaucracy, which is what we see today. The modern bureaucracy's resistance to a combative Trump, ignoring the plain language of Congress time and again, and puppeteering an oblivious President Biden. A thought toward the end of On Liberty, I think in the end is to me the most impactful. Check this out. The worth of the state in the long run is the worth of the individuals composing it. The state that suppresses the individual and makes people small-minded will yield no great accomplishments. Perhaps the individual is going to have to once again reign supreme in the United States of America if we want to secure a bright future. Wow, on liberty. Mill wrote that in 1859. That was also the year that Colonel Edwin Drake drilled the first commercial oil well in the world in the state of Pennsylvania, about an hour and a half north of where I sit. He and his well changed the world for the better. Thank God Drake had the benefit of individual liberty to make the most of it. The Drake well is located in Venango County, up, as I said, in northwestern Pennsylvania. It sits along the east bank of Oil Creek. The site was originally on an artificial island formed by the creek and a mill race. And on a floodplain, the well and the museum today are protected by a dike. Petroleum was found along Oil Creek and was known to Native Americans for hundreds of years through natural seeps. European settlers became aware of the existence of petroleum in that area in the 1600s. And at the time, what they called mineral oil was used mostly for medicinal purposes and was reputed to cure many ailments, including arthritis. But around 1848, the potential of the medicinal oil as an illuminant, it started to be appreciated. And then enters Edwin Drake, a former conductor for a railroad who invested $200, his entire savings, into a company that was formed to hold the rights of a farm along the banks of Oil Creek. It was called the Pennsylvania Rock Oil Company. Drake became involved in the company and traveled to Titusville, Pennsylvania. In late 1857, he decided that drilling in the manner of salt wells would yield more petroleum, so he built an engine house and a derrick, and he put in a 6-horsepower steam engine to basically ram the drill through soil until it reached bedrock. And it was found that groundwater would cause the walls of the bore to collapse, so he used cast iron pipe to stabilize the hole. After reaching the bedrock, he drilled at a rate of 3 feet per day, which is sort of laughable thinking about today's technology and advance rates. And his colleagues back east gave up hope finding any oil. He was running out of money. By 1859, after spending $2,500, Drake took out a $500 loan to desperately keep the operation going. The drilling reached its maximum depth of just under 70 feet in August of 1859. You could see oil on top of the water, 5 inches from the top of the well. And the original structures at the well caught fire in October of 1859 and were rebuilt by Drake a month later. How about this? The well produced somewhere between 12 to 20 barrels a day. But after the price of oil plummeted from the resulting oil boom, that well was never profitable. The well stopped producing in 1861, and the owner sold the property in 1864. The derrick was moved a couple decades later to the Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia, I think in 1876. So as is often the case with innovation, history was made here, but not money, at least initially. The making of the money would come for the oil industry soon enough. Today, the Drake Well Museum encompasses 22 acres. It surrounds the well. Museum's got a station on the Oil Creek and Titusville Railroad. Cool place to visit, especially in the summer. Check it out if you're ever in the area and you're able to. And check out some of our back episodes of The Far Middle. You can find those on Spotify and Amazon Music and Apple Podcasts, or again on nickdeolius.com, along with all the other content that we post there, including that On Liberty piece that we discussed on today's episode. And don't you dare to forget to check out next week's episode of The Far Middle. And until then, I wish you only the best.